Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Christopher Jones Cruz, Anna Mateo, Dan Friedel, and Anne Ball. Later, Steve Ember will bring us a special Making of a Nation report on the Second World War. But first, here are Christopher Jones Cruz and Anna Mateo.
Recently, we reported on the importance of counties in the United States. Today, we have a lot more on what the U.S. Census Bureau calls the primary political and administrative divisions of states. There are more than 3,000 counties nationwide.
Most states use the word county to describe these subdivisions, or separate areas, within a larger territory. Naturally, there are exceptions to this definition. For example, the southern state of Louisiana is divided up into parishes. The Census Bureau reports that 1,653 counties lost population between 2010 and 2015. That is more than half of all counties nationwide. At the same time, the general population grew by about 4%. Delaware and Hawaii are the only two states that did not have a single county with a falling population number. If not for new immigrants, 194 more U.S. counties would have lost population.
More people are dying than are being born in more than one-third of all counties. Population experts call this natural decrease. Some news stories have described counties that record more deaths than births as dying counties. In 2009, the Census Bureau reported natural decrease in 880 counties. In 2012, the Census Bureau estimated natural decrease in 1,135 counties. Most were in rural areas.
Kenneth Johnson is a professor of sociology at the University of New Hampshire. He told the Associated Press that the number of counties with natural decrease is rising, not only because there are fewer births than deaths in those areas. He said another reason is an increase in the number of deaths among baby boomers. The term baby boomer is used to describe the 70 million Americans who were born between 1946 and 1964. Johnson said, "I expect natural decrease to remain high in the future. These counties are in a pretty steep downward spiral. The young people leave, and the older adults stay in place and age."
About 46% of rural counties experienced natural decrease. That compares to 17% of counties in populated areas. Experts say counties die because they have increasingly older populations, a low birth rate, and a poor economy. They say it is difficult for some areas to retain or attract younger people. Japan and many European countries have been experiencing natural decrease for many years.
In the United States, the 10 largest counties are in the West, in states such as California, Arizona, and Nevada. Some of the smallest counties are in eastern states. The first counties were created in Virginia in the 1630s. Maryland and Massachusetts established counties a short time later. The Census Bureau says there are 3,031 counties nationwide, but the National Association of Counties says there are 3,069. Association officials told VOA they use the term counties for both county governments and county geographies with county governments.
5 of the 10 smallest counties by population are in the state of Nebraska. Cook County, Illinois, which includes Chicago, is the second most populous county in the nation. It has more people than 29 states and more than the 7 smallest states combined. The top 4 most densely populated counties are in the New York City area. The top 4 least densely populated counties are in Alaska. Some cities and counties have joined together. The city and county are controlled by one government. These include the city and borough of Anchorage, Alaska, and the city and county of San Francisco, California. Yet the state of Virginia has 39 independent cities that are not part of any county.
Generally, county governments are strongest in the western and southern United States, and weakest in the east, where there are more cities. Few counties create laws like state legislatures and city councils do. Most just enforce state laws. I'm Ana Mateo.
And I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Soccer fans around the world love to question the calls that the referees make during games. One common insult is to say the referee must not be able to see well. A new study says most referees can see just fine. Belgian and British researchers found that the best referees, however, are able to pay attention to the parts of a play where a foul is most likely to happen. These referees can ignore other less important parts of a play. Inexperienced referees, however, are not as precise or exact. The study was published in October in the journal Cognitive Research. Werner Helsen was a co-author of the study. He is a sports scientist and a professor at Belgium's University of Leuven. He also helps train officials for FIFA and UEFA, the governing body of European soccer. Helsen said there have been several studies done on soccer players. Researchers have studied how some of the best athletes see the games they play. Researchers ask the players to look at pictures or videos of a game. They follow the players' eyes to see what they look at first and for how long. Before the new study, researchers had not examined soccer referees in the same way. Referees who call games from top soccer leagues and lower soccer leagues took part in the study. Helsen and his team showed 40 referees videos of soccer games. The researchers used special technology to watch how their eyes moved. Helsen said the best referees focused their eyes on the most important parts of plays. That means they did not pay attention to what Helsen called irrelevant or unimportant details. The best referees do not, in fact, have better vision than the others, but they do have more experience and they know what they should look for.
It is the meaning your mind can give to something you are looking at that makes the big difference, and that makes the difference between being elite or not elite.
Helsin compares what the best referees see on the field to what an experienced doctor might see from an X-ray. A less experienced doctor might take longer to look at an X-ray to find the problem. Soccer organizations like FIFA and UEFA want to have the best referees at the biggest games. But there are not many chances for referees to practice calling foul plays. Helsin says referees need more chances to train and practice, just as soccer players do.
The refereeing is practice poor. We need to find more tools to give them more experience outside the game.
Helsin and other researchers are working on a website that can help train referees. It is called Perception for Perfection. Referees used the website before the 2016 European Championship Tournament. They looked at 700 videos that showed how a soccer team can be offside. It is a difficult call to make because players are moving very fast. The referee needs to see three things at the same time: the ball, the offensive team's player, and the defensive team's player. After watching the videos for less than 24 hours, the skill level of some of the referees increased by 30%. I'm Dan Friedel.
In the American state of Idaho, a robot moves between lines of fruit trees and grapevines. It is doing farm work. Called IdaBot, this robot is a prototype or model. An engineering team at Northwest Nazarene University in Nampa, Idaho, developed IdaBot. It looks like a small military tank, but it is armed with cameras and radio frequency sensors instead of guns. It moves slowly through an orchard, spraying chemicals on each plant that needs treatment. It can do other jobs too, including watching over crops and harvesting them. The robot uses radio frequency identification in its work. This process uses electronic devices on the trees or grapevines to identify them. As the IdaBot moves through the orchards, it reads the devices on the plants to learn what it needs. Josh Griffin is one of the project leaders. He explains how the robot works.
He can program into the IdaBot trees number 1 and trees number 5 need chemicals. Each tree would have a radio frequency identification tag on it, and the IdaBot would use the signal from the tag to determine which tree it's next to. And when it's next to tree 5, it'll spray chemicals on tree number 5. When it's on tree number 1, it'll spray the chemicals there.
Griffin, an assistant engineering professor, says the robot can work on its own. It can also work with other technology, like drones, small pilotless planes. In an experiment, a drone carried a special camera that captures images of grapevines or fruit trees. The image information is processed through a computer program. The color of the image lets the robot know how much chemical the plants need. Griffin says
the robot can help farmers save money on labor. It also saves money by reducing the use of chemicals, and that helps the environment.
It automatically, without human intervention, applies the chemicals, and then it does so at very low pressure, so it does so very precisely. The chemicals go where we want them to go, not overspray to other areas.
The robot team of students and professors is also developing a fruit counting application for the IDABOT. It uses a vision system to correctly estimate the size of the fruit crop. Duke Bulanan, another assistant engineering professor, works with Griffin on the project. He explains that the system will use several different kinds of cameras, color, near-infrared, and stereo cameras. They will take images from each tree as IDABOT moves along the orchard.
And then we will use those images and create a computer program to estimate the number of fruits on each tree.
Farmer Michael Williamson owns an orchard in Caldwell, Idaho. He says he is looking forward to trying out the computer program on his trees.
I am very excited about this experiment and this machine that can count our fruit. We can get a better price from our customers if we pre-order or pre-sell our fruit months in advance. Sometimes it can be better than 20%, and that is the important part about the fruit counting.
Being able to get a correct count of the fruit helps in many ways. Farmer Williamson says if they have a correct count of the fruit, he can predict how many people he needs for the harvest. He can also predict how many shipping boxes he will need to ship them. And, he says, he can predict the market. How much would farmers have to pay for this robot? Big pieces of farm equipment can be expensive. But Griffin estimates a basic IDABOT that uses radio frequency identification technology would be relatively low cost.
We do anticipate that it will be fairly affordable, you know, kind of on the order of maybe buying a pickup truck or something like that.
The researchers expect the money the farmers save by using this robot would also help consumers because they will find lower fruit prices at the market. I'm Ann Ball.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The United States entered the Second World War in December of 1941. Europe had already been at war since 1939, but the United States did not enter World War II until Japanese forces attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. The attack was a surprise, but American military and political leaders had believed that the United States, sooner or later, would be pulled into the fighting, and they began to prepare for war. President Franklin Roosevelt had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy under President Woodrow Wilson during World War I. He remembered how American troops were not ready for that war. Now that he was president, Roosevelt wanted to be sure that the United States would be ready when it had to fight. Throughout 1941, Roosevelt urged American industries to produce more weapons and other military supplies. He established new government agencies to work with industry to increase arms production. Some business leaders resisted Roosevelt's efforts. They felt there was no need to produce more arms while the United States was still at peace. But many others cooperated, and by the time Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, the American economy was producing millions of guns and other weapons. Still, this was not enough to fight a war. After the Japanese attack, Roosevelt increased his demands on American industry. He called for 60,000 warplanes, 45,000 tanks, and 20,000 anti-aircraft guns. And he wanted all these within 1 year. A month after the Pearl Harbor raid, Roosevelt organized a special committee to direct military production. He created another group to help companies find men and women for defense work. And he established a new office where the nation's best scientists and engineers could work together to design new weapons. These new government organizations faced several problems. Sometimes factories produced too much of one product and not enough of another. Sometimes tools broke, and some business owners refused to accept government orders. But the weapons were produced, and American troops soon had the guns and supplies they needed. The federal government had to quickly expand its own workforce to meet war needs. Federal spending increased from $6 billion in 1940 to $89 billion in 1944. That was 15 times as much spending in just 5 years. Roosevelt had to take strong steps to get the money for all this spending. He put limits on wages. He increased income taxes to as much as 94% on portions of incomes over $200,000. And he asked the American people to lend money to the federal government. The people answered by purchasing almost $100 billion in war bonds. The great increase in public spending raised the threat of high inflation. Roosevelt created a special office with the power to control prices. Many Americans agreed with the idea of price controls, but every business wanted somebody else's prices controlled, not their own. Federal officials had to work hard to keep prices and supplies under control. They restricted how much meat, fuel, and other goods people could buy. The price control program generally worked. Its success kept the American economy strong to support the troops fighting in Europe and Asia. One reason these strong economic steps worked was because most of the American people fully supported the war effort.
She's the part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory. Rosie the Riveter.
You can look at photographs of people from those times and see in their faces how strongly they felt. In one picture from the state of North Carolina, a group of men are standing in front of old rubber tires. They are planning to give the tires to the Army to be fixed and used for military vehicles. Another photo shows a woman visiting a hospital. She is singing to a soldier to lift his spirits. Still another photo shows a man who owns a small food store. He is placing signs on meat and cans of food to tell people how much they are allowed to buy. You can also get an idea about the feelings of the times by the names of some of the popular songs during World War II.
Praise the Lord to pass the ammunition. Praise the Lord to pass the ammunition.
in addition to Rosie the Riveter, there were songs like Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition. Not all Americans supported the war. A small number refused to fight because of religious or moral beliefs. They were known as conscientious objectors. And some Americans supported Adolf Hitler and other fascists. But almost everyone else wanted to win the war quickly and return to a normal life. Many Japanese Americans served with honor in the United States Armed Forces. But many Americans were suspicious of anyone whose family had come from Japan. They refused to trust even Japanese American families who had lived in the United States for more than a century. Many banks refused to lend money to Japanese Americans. Many stores would not sell to them. The federal government relocated thousands of Japanese Americans in California and other states into internment camps. They were released only after the war ended. It was many years before the government officially apologized for mistreating Japanese Americans. But World War II did lead to progress for another group that was often the target of discrimination, Black Americans. Black leaders spoke out. They said it was unfair to fight a war for freedom in Europe while Black Americans did not have all the same freedoms as white citizens.
We've got to want the same things that white citizens possess. All of Europe, and no force under the sun can stem and block and stop this civil rights revolution which is now underway.
In 1941, a leader in the Black community, A. Philip Randolph, threatened to lead a giant march on Washington for civil rights for Blacks. President Roosevelt reacted by issuing an order that made it a crime to deny Blacks a chance for jobs in defense industries. He also ordered the armed forces to change some of their rules that discriminated against Black service members. Blacks made progress in the military and defense industries, but most other industries still refused to give them an equal chance. Major progress on civil rights would not come until the 1950s and 60s. Life was busy during the war years. There were many changes in the economy, business, music, race relations, and other areas. But in many ways, life continued as it always does. Americans did what they could during the hard years of World War II to keep life on the home front as normal as possible. But almost everyone understood that the first job was to support the troops overseas and win the war. This strength of purpose at home gave American soldiers the support they needed, and it also helped President Roosevelt as he negotiated with other world leaders. Diplomacy and foreign relations became much more complex during the war. That will be our story next week.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.